Good morning, everybody, or good afternoon, everybody, whenever it is you get your podcast fix. My name is Derek Smith, and this is the Truth or Derek Show, or the Truth or Derek Podcast. You know how we roll around here. You can call it whatever you want. I always say reach out to me. I got a bunch of good messages and everything. We're doing a little something different this week. We're dropping 2 episodes in 2 days, so if you guys are used to Josh and Franz on Monday mornings, you're going to have to wait for tomorrow, because this is a special episode, and we have the great Joseph Scott Morgan stopping by. You know him from TV, very, very famous forensic death investigator, wrote an incredible book, just an incredible guy. We ran a little bit long, so I'll do my normal ranting and raving on the next episode, which you only have to wait for tomorrow. So, yeah, I have lots of fun today. I guarantee you guys are you're going to enjoy this one, but not nearly as much as we enjoy as www.podstars.net. Yes, you see that? I am the master of sliding that in there, but, you know, come on, we got to do this stuff. We're all in this together, Bo. If you want to take your podcasting career to the next level, go to www.podstars.net. Podstars is a talented and passionate community that will give you the opportunity to interview top professionals from a variety of industries, where they will share their insights and experiences with your audience. Plus, everybody will have access to the exclusive celebrity catalog featuring some of the best in the business, both new and established. It is also free to join. As a member of Podstars, you can choose from the catalog of celebrities to interview on your podcast. And if interested, for an additional monthly fee of only $8.99, you can upgrade to the community plan, a completely different and exciting catalog full of some of the best experts and professionals in their fields today, as well as access to everybody in the whole Podstars universe. It is a great way to invest in your podcast, as you will save time and money by being able to book guests from one platform with an expansive catalog that is constantly being added to. So why wait? Come on, don't wait. Join www.podstars.net now and start exploring all that they have to offer. You will not want to miss out on this amazing opportunity to elevate your podcasting career and take it to the next level. Join the community. Come on, hop on. Again, we switched up the music today because, forensic death investigator obviously made me think of Halloween music. Again, we're doing things a little bit differently this week. I'll be back with Josh and Franz on tomorrow morning. The episode will come out, so don't stress, we're not going anywhere. I got an opportunity to talk with Joseph Scott Morgan, and I could not pass it up. So a little bonus, a little extra podcasting this week. As always, you guys know you can reach out to me. If you have any thoughts, questions, anything, good, bad, ugly, doesn't matter. Let me know. And without further ado, let's do it. Mr. Joseph Scott Morgan. Well, if you're anyone anywhere in the world of true crime, you know my next guest. He is arguably the best forensic death investigator around. He hosts what is, in a lot of people's opinions, including mine, one of the best true crime podcasts around, Body Bags. He's on TV. He rocks classes at Jacksonville State University. Please welcome Georgia Author of the Year for Blood Beneath My Feet, Mr. Joseph Scott Morgan. How you doing?
Doing good, dude. I'm doing really good. Good to meet you finally, Derek.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. Now,
going back and forth.
Yeah, well, I originally, Cheryl McCollum came on 4 months ago, and she brought you up. She's like, you got to get him on. But like, I see you and I see your schedule and your podcast and all that. Man, you are crazy, crazy busy.
Yeah. And, you know, it's always, I see every opportunity. I rarely say no. I'm not in the atmosphere to say no. I'm not a cool kid like that. And plus, I like to have
good for everything.
I like to have conversations with people as it applies to forensics. You know, I don't have too much else contained in my brain other than stuff that I talk about with relative to forensics. And so if people are interested in talking about it and talking about death investigation, that sort of thing, I'm all about it. And it's what I've done my entire life. So, and the more you do it, it's like anything, man. It's literally like anything, whether you're working in the morgue or you're doing a scene investigation or swinging a golf club, you're going to get better if you just persist and you continue to work on it. And, You grow in those areas, and I hope I've grown, over these years.
So I want to get obviously to all the stuff that's going on now, because like again, people will learn throughout the interview, but also like hopefully if they pick up your book and that sort of thing. Like with everybody that I talk to, I like to say, like let's go back to the beginning, and it usually starts with, law enforcement or law school or that sort of thing in their 20s and 30s. But like your backstory is just like unlike anything I've ever heard. So I don't know how far back you want to go, but the obvious question is, with the 99% of the world that would run away from dead bodies, what made you kind of focus in on that?
I've held over the years, I've had other people ask me that question, and it's not like somebody had a gun to my head making me do it. And the positions that I found myself in, many of them quite horrible, some of the things I've seen over the years. And my story's not too much different than anybody else that works in my field. You have to make an active choice. I believe in, that we're all agents of free will. So, I made a decision to do what I did. I found it intellectually stimulating, and even at a young age, I felt as though that it was a skill set that, particularly when I started back in the early 80s, it was a skill set that not too many people had. We're way before the days of what would be considered, like true crime, and certainly people studying forensics in college. So it was a unique niche to be in, and I'm very grateful for the opportunities I had. And I wanted to be excellent at something. And I can't say that I'm excellent at a lot of things in my life. I feel like I'm a pretty decent death investigator.
Good podcaster too.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. That's a work of love, because it, again, it's supposed to, it's I set it up so that it's educational, because I've taught college now. Wow. May 4th will be my 20th year in higher ed.
Don't look that old.
Yeah. Well, it's not the years, it's the miles.
Yeah, I hear that.
That's what Indiana Jones said in the first, first movie. Yeah. So, but I started out very young. I started out as a death investigator. The years vary; they kind of run together. I was around my first death or death investigation when I was 21, and I had no business doing what I was doing. I was working in the morgue, essentially, under the direction of a really good forensic pathologist that felt as though that I had some talent in the area, and I was willing to do stuff that other people weren't willing to do, like, sweep up maggots,
Oh,
clean up comp fluid,
yeah.
and all of the nastiness that comes along with working in a morgue. But on the flip side, the morgue, out of all the education that I've had over the years, the morgue was the best classroom I have ever been in, bar none. Because it breathes life, no pun intended. It breathes life into science for me, and you can kind of conjure up, these people that have passed on. You're there to figure out a gigantic puzzle, and you don't have anybody giving you any clues other than the dead guy most of the time. And so it's if you enjoy science and you can get past the horror of what you're beholding, it's a rewarding career. It was for me. Of course, I paid a price for it later on. That's the reason I wrote Blood Beneath My Feet. But
We'll get to that.
yeah, but being in the midst of it and doing all of that, it was grand. Best classroom I've ever been in.
So I know that in the notes that you were one at the time the youngest person who had that job in the country. So again, being drawn to that sort of thing, and like you just said, starting at the beginning with sweeping up maggots and stuff. I mean, you were 21 years old, like. Part of you didn't want to go out, drink and do drugs and, chase loose women, as they said back then.
I didn't know those two things were mutually exclusive.
But
Gotta blow, listen, I started my career off in New Orleans. You can't avoid that stuff. Even
yeah.
in the midst of all the carnage that you run across down there, I still had a social life.
Right.
Didn't do drugs, but I drank. I drank enough liquor to float a battleship, you know,
Mm-hmm.
unscannered. Yeah, I did a lot of drinking, and had good times. But, you know, again, just like the morgue was a laboratory for me to learn in, New Orleans was a grand laboratory to learn in because you see things there that you don't see, certainly in the rest of the states, because New Orleans is such a unique location. It's probably, as far as America is concerned, it is the most, in my opinion, it's the most European of all American cities. You know, and my family has inhabited that region. My family actually had a Spanish land grant. So they go back prior to the occupation of the French even. So yeah, my part of my family timbered some of the materials that went into building the French Quarter. So that's how far back, you know, my family goes. They weren't original settlers, but they had been there for a while. And, you know, and New Orleans is so unique because people forget it's a major port city. And, you know, all of the traffic that comes in from South America, just coffee alone that comes through New Orleans. Part of my family has a coffee company. And you know, my cousin goes down to the docks to this day and bids on pallets of coffee that he
Really?
takes and roast. Yeah. And that's just been, New Orleans is unique that way. You get freighters that, you know, I worked probably one of the most brutal homicides that I've ever worked was on a Liberian registered ship with an all Korean crew, where I had a guy that was the first, I'm an army guy, so I was not in the Navy, but he was the first mate to the chef, and he pissed the chef off, and the chef took a meat cleaver to this guy and hit him 130 times and killed him. And
See.
they were coming around South America, set Straits of Magellan. I never can keep all that straight. Cape Horn, Straits of Magellan, one's African, one's, it doesn't matter. Anyway,
You know where they landed. That's important.
in my jurisdiction. And what they had done, what made it so unique, was that they'd taken this guy. If you've never seen one of these tanker ships, they have freezers on them, but they have like these super duper freezers. And so they froze this guy. And there was a scene in Goodfellas where I think it was Carbone, where they've got him hanging up in the meat locker, and it took them 2 or 3 days to do the autopsy because they had to let him thaw out. That literally happened in this case for me, where we had to leave the guy on the table for, I think it was like 2 days, before we could put the cold steel to him. And you don't, you know, and I left there and went to Atlanta and worked for the ME there. And Atlanta's very milquetoast. It's very boring, you know.
Really? Because it seems like
There's,
it's one of the hotbeds for just, well, it's no Florida, but still, it seems like in the world of true crime. See, like that was one of the other things that I wanted to ask, because obviously, I mean, whether you're too proud to admit it, you're pretty much at the top of your game, like everywhere. Again, anyone who listens to the podcast, you can hear the bluntness and everything and the technique and all that. But at some point, is that like where you are now? Are you in like a high demand kind of where your phone is ringing off the hook saying, you know what, we got a suspicious death, we got a suspicious death, like we need you here? Do you deal with a lot of that?
No, I don't. I have people that call me and want me to consult on cases. Most of the time, I don't touch that. I don't go out into the field. The stuff, the analysis I do, serves the purpose of my interest in the media and trying to aid the media in getting the story right from the forensics perspective. And if you'll allow me to kind of tell a quick little anecdotal story here.
Yeah, please go.
I don't know if I know you're up in Ontario, and I would assume that you might have a memory of this. This was probably back in 17, I think, or it may have predated 17. Anyway, we had a rash in America of police officers being killed. This predates all the George Floyd stuff and all of that, and we had these multiple attacks with military grade weapons that we had in Baton Rouge. We had a couple other ones, but the one I'm referring to is the one that occurred in Dallas. And I was doing stuff on CNN and HLN primarily. And I was sitting there one night, and my wife and I were, in the drawing room, in our living room, just kind of watching television. And we had it on, we were switching back and forth between channels, and we landed on Fox, and there was a shooting that was going on in Dallas. And you had a couple of police officers that were killed and others that were desperately wounded. And they had this person that was on Fox. This person was an attorney, but they claimed that they had an expertise in forensics. And
A lawyer who does forensics on the side.
yeah, and this person claimed claimed that this weapon that they were using, I could look at it and tell that it was probably an AR platform, Armalite platform, probably an M4. At the time, I was unsure. And she's like, "Oh yeah, well, you can go to any store," and she's implying like Walmart and Target, and you can buy a high capacity magazine, and this is how a magazine works. And then she referred to it as clip, which for those of us in forensics know that there's no such thing as clips unless you're talking about an M1 Garand and a few other weapons. It's primarily magazines. I'm thinking this person's an idiot.
It's like a weird style of like a Monday morning quarterback. Like you can go back and you can watch the tape and you can go like, this guy like doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about.
Right. And so I'm watching this thing and I'm thinking, this individual is claiming that they are a forensics expert. And I'm not the greatest expert in the world, but I've spent my time, working in forensics. I've got a graduate degree in forensics. I'm a college professor. There's a lot of people like that out there. But I looked at this and I thought, that individual is selling themselves as a forensic expert. And that reflects on us. And so I purposed from that moment on, already been doing television. I was like, you know what? Any opportunity that I have, I know this sounds so Pollyanna, but
You're gonna save the world.
any opportunity I have to educate people, I'm going to do it. And it's not all, look, I know nobody's a fool. It's not all altruism on my part. I have an ego too, obviously.
Want
And
to be right.
yeah, but I wanted to, kind of set the record straight and try to explain these things so that people, because people get really confused about forensics. Most people
It
that
is because there's so much. Like it's one of those things where even when I was sitting down trying to think of some stuff to talk to you about, I was like, "There's no way you can tell me about forensics in an hour. It's impossible."
Yeah, it is. And interesting, Derek, one of the things I tell my students at JSU is like, look, in the intro class, which I'm teaching a section, it's like freshmen and sophomores, and I'm just kind of, pulling back the veil a little bit on forensics for these kids that think they want to go into the field. And I'll say to them, listen, if somebody tells you that they are a forensic scientist, the next question, just like a physician, you should say, well, what kind of forensic scientist are you? Are you a question document person? Are you a toxicology person? Are you a DNA specialist? Are you a ballistics expert? Serology, whatever, forensic anthropology, medical legal death investigation, which is the area I dance in. And it just goes on. It's such a broad spectrum. So for somebody to say, well, yeah, I'm a forensic scientist, the next question, it's like you wouldn't go to a psychiatrist to f fix a broken leg, at
Yeah,
least.
or like when you say I'm a lawyer, but I'm a real estate lawyer.
Ain't judging, just saying. No, I mean, and that's kind of the way I look at it. And so and there are things that are way outside of my depth, but I've got friends. That's the cool thing about it in forensics. We're kind of a small community. And so if I have a question, I can reach out to them and ask them, look, I don't want to look like any more of a fool than I already am. Can you clarify this or direct me to a reading that I need to go to? And the thing about it is things happen so quickly, and they've been happening so quickly now for it seems as though it almost started with me with a Vegas shooting. It seems like it hasn't slowed down since Vegas, really.
I agree. You know what's odd is I actually stayed at Mandalay Bay and I walked that. Just it was after when because like I'm sorry, just when you were talking about everyone working together, when Cheryl McCollum and I first became friends, she seems like a genius. I mean, well, you guys are in the same kind of the same circle with Nancy Grace and all that, where it's like, you can go on there and you talk and you discuss the cases and all that. But she said, you know what, behind the scenes, she's like, I call in favors all the time. I call experts all the time and all this. And like, the better people in the business that you're in are eager to help other people because, we all want the same goal.
You want to get it right. And listen, I'm not a police officer. I don't, and a lot of people might cringe at this. I don't have an interest in seeking justice, whatever in the hell that means, because it means so much to everybody else. I just want to understand the science and be able to explain the science. And I think that any good forensic scientist, that's their measure. You just want to tell the truth as revealed by the science. And it doesn't matter, if it is anthropology or ballistics or toxicology or handwriting or, you name it, you go down the list, arson, you just want to tell what you're observing and what your tests have revealed. And then there's a whole nother group of people out there, with, that have an interest in catching the bad guys. In my area, in medical legal death investigation, which for those that are listening and don't really know, that's the realm of the coroner and the medical examiner. So if you think about a person like me, and there are people like me out there right now doing the job here, and they're doing the job up in Canada too. You have a coronal system up there. It came to us, it's first mentioned in the Magna Carta. It's, if you look at, I think it's the 27th paragraph. There's three words you can make out there: sheriff, bailiff, and coroner. That's how
Right.
old the office is. It's like 1276 or something, I think, when the Magna Carta was written. It's an ancient office and it's evolved over a period of time. You want to be able to explain to people from a medical legal perspective what happened to this individual. It doesn't mean they're going to be prosecuted. There are disagreements between the medical legal community and law enforcement community all the time, where we will rule something as an accidental death and they'll call it a homicide, and the prosecutor will move forward and try to prosecute that case. It all depends on how we look at it. There's a couple of coroners out there that famously, they don't rule illicit drug ODs as accidental deaths. Many do. There's a couple, and one famously up in Pennsylvania, actually at the site, can't remember the name of the little town, the town where they have the Little League World Series.
Yeah.
That coroner there, if he has an illicit, or he did, I don't know what the status is now. You can look it up. There's an article about it. Any death he had that was related to a drug OD of an illicit substance, he ruled that automatically as a homicide. So is it the coroner will rule that and call it that? That doesn't mean the prosecutor is going to pick it up and prosecute it, though.
Well, see, the more you learn about the world of true crime and stuff, I don't want to say that that creates unnecessary backlog, but with the delay of information and the way the system is set up and all that, you almost prefer to get somebody like you or someone that's less kind of beat around the bush and kind of more blunt. Where, I don't exactly know how it works, but let's just say, for example, a body comes in and they put it in front of you. On average, I mean, assuming it's not a tricky case, how long would it take you, do you think, to figure out whether it was a homicide or some other death?
Well, you were right to qualify that, Derek, because complicated. It seems as though that every case has some level of complication. Some things are very straightforward. You've got a multiple gunshot wound case, pretty
It's
easy.
usually the gunshots.
Yeah, but exactly. But you have to be keyed into things like, do you have a scene involving staging? One of my biggest nightmares was always working suicides involving hangings and how my assessment was going to be, because that is rife for staging, where an individual can be asphyxiated and then hung post-mortem to give the appearance that it is a self-inflicted event where they're taking their own life, but they're trying to mask something else. And there are countless kind of iterations of that. So that's why I'm kind of simple-minded. A lot of people do this. My baseline is that when I walk into a scene, I go on and on about being open-minded and middle of the road, but my working assumption anytime that I go into a scene is that every death is a homicide until I can prove otherwise. And
Which is good.
if you imagine a big pyramid, I just kind of start at the top and just kind of work my way down, because you have the most to lose if you miss a homicide. And I've missed homicides. I'm chief among sinners. I've done that. And so you have to kind of tick the boxes as you go down. Just you can really be influenced, I think, particularly a young investigator in my field, if you show up at the scene and you've got a police officer standing there, maybe a uniform police officer, and they say, "Yeah, we got a suicide inside." And I'm not going to sit there and take time to, educate that individual on the finer points. There's a dead body that I need to go examine, but you take a grain of salt because you can always miss something.
So that being said, like you were just saying, as a younger investigator, like you were obviously in those shoes and trying to learn in school and all that sort of thing. So you learn obviously as you move forward, okay, a number of ways this person could have died and then was eventually staged. Does sometimes you go back at a case in your head, and I don't want to say it haunts you or keeps you up at night, but just thinking, this was unusual. Did I miss something? Did I overlook that? Like, maybe not so much now because, fine-tuned, but maybe when you were younger.
No, my skill has diminished in that area because I'm not practiced. I can look at things now and I can point out in generalities, but that's why it's so important that we had a big problem for a long time with in our field, where people would not attend the scenes, if you can imagine that. And I'm talking about if it was a homicide, they'd go out to the scenes. And I'm not talking about cops, I'm talking about people in my field. They had these broad-ranging working assumptions. They would simply send a wagon out there to pick up the body and retrieve it and bring it back in. You miss so much when you do that because you need to see the body in its pristine state and what forensic pathologists refer to as being in situ. So in place, in the environment in which they apparently have died, you have to contextualize it and see it there. And it's those cases where you get so overwhelmed on a shift and you're working. And I spent holidays in Atlanta, working. I know one Christmas I worked a 12-hour shift. I think I caught 20 deaths.
Jeez.
Yeah. And it was me. That's it. And I covered all of Atlanta and all of Fulton County, which is the broader area. And again, I'm not alone in that story. There are other people that can tell the tale. But you reflect back to those moments, particularly when, because you're going from case to case to case, and every case is different. So you might have, Atlanta, for instance, is notorious for their roadways. It's bad. Traffic is horrible there. And you'd get high speed crashes all the time. And the area that you cover in the land mass is extensive. So you might have a homicide. I mean, I'm sorry, forgive me. You might have a motor vehicle accident in one area of the county that you have to go to and examine that body and determine what happened. But you might have a suicide holding. Then you might have a gunshot wound that's rolled into a hospital. And you're going to have to tick all those boxes as you go along. And sometimes, a little comic interlude here for those who are really old. It's kind of like the old scene from the Lucy show where Lucy and Ethel are trying to do the chocolates on the conveyor belt, and they're
Right.
sticking them down their shirt, and sticking them in their mouths, and the cases just keep coming and coming and coming. And death, as rote as it sounds, death never takes a holiday. It doesn't. Death doesn't care if it's Christmas or Thanksgiving or, whatever the case might be. And sometimes it's even more pronounced on those days because you get families that are together. There's angry words that are exchanged. You have people that do
Alcohol, drugs.
alcohol. You have people taking their lives. You have people taking other people's lives. You have people dying in car crashes. So it can get a bit overwhelming. And here's the thing, if you go to the general public and you begin to talk to them about medical legal death investigation, I'm not talking about people that are interested in true crime. That's a separate set of the population that many of those people are my friends, that are so-called fans. I don't like to use that word, but I'm talking about the general population. Most people don't think about what we do. They don't want to think about what we do because
No.
I've made this comment in other interviews. My wife think our
When you get
birth.
home, she's like, "How was your day, honey?" You're like, "Fuck, don't ask."
This is when we first started dating. Matter of fact, I think it may, I know it was our first date, and we'd gone to a Braves game and went to see the Braves play Toronto
Hey.
in Atlanta. And it was in June of 98. And it's a Friday evening. We lost, by the way, to Toronto. Smoltz was good.
Oh.
And we went to a pizza restaurant afterwards. And my wife is a public educator, which her job is a lot tougher than mine, I think. But we were sitting across the table, eating pizza. And I was trying to explain to her what I did for a living.
The entry level.
And Derek, she looked at me and said, until I met you, I've never thought about death.
No, it's a,
Now you can take that any
and
number of ways. Yeah, you hadn't thought about death, until you met me, or gee, I hadn't really thought about what happens to the dead. And most people don't.
no, and you know what? And that's really why your book is amazing. I mean, my wife is reading it now. I read it when I knew that we were going to get a chance to talk. And again, why I was saying your podcast was so good, because it's the factual parts, it's the bluntness of it and all that. Like, okay, yeah, you don't think of it. Nobody does. You just think people die of old age. They come over, they say that's what it was. They zip you up. You go to a funeral home. They put you in the ground, and that's it. But then the more and more you learn about the process and the suspicious deaths and this, and like you were just saying, getting 20 calls in one day and having to go check them all out, like it just, again, I was joking when I was putting it after your intro, where your part where I talk you out, I was like, and if you never want to sleep again, pick up his book, because it's just, it's just, I mean, it's a horrifying situation, but it's a job that you have to have experts in. Or else, I would imagine 80 or 90% of suspicious deaths, they do come down to the death investigator. That's just, it's a necessary part of what is a really bad, scenario.
It does, and a lot of that goes to a lot of that goes to your comfort level with the dead. And let me explain that. You can have a homicide detective, which we've got. There's in America, there are any number of archetypes, for that in fiction and that sort of thing, and even in true crime, you've got all of these homicide detectives that are out there that have some kind of show or have done, work as homicide detectives. Even the most robust homicide detective, they don't necessarily want to spend a lot of time with a decomposing body. I'm not saying that that lessens them or their investigative prowess. Matter of fact, it probably helps them because I'm the idiot that would stay there with a decomposing
For
body
four
for
days.
The flies lighting on me and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to seek out information that the body can reveal, at that scene, at that moment in time, because I do understand this. I understand this idea of working on a timeline, and I mean that from a practical standpoint. It's like if I don't do this right now, if I don't do the best job I can, despite how horrible, in spite rather of how horrible it might be to everybody else, where, and I could go into great graphic detail, which I won't, but, just talking about that environment that you're in. First off, you have to want to be there. It's the only way you're going to sharpen your skills, and
Yeah.
there's not enough Vicks you can put under your nose to kill the smell, because,
Silence of the
yeah, which is the biggest joke on the face of the planet. Okay.
Lambs.
You don't like Vicks. Not only that's not going to knock down decomp, so now you got to spell Vicks and decomp.
Yeah.
And for a long time, I don't know about you, Derek, but every now and then I enjoy a really nice cigar.
Yes.
Early on, there were these detectives that you would come across, the older detectives, and they would have the biggest, fattest, nastiest cigar that you can imagine. They kept in the car for the purposes of smoking that on the scene of a decomposing body. I'd rather smell the decomposing body. First off, you got bad taste in cigars.
Yeah.
And secondly, you obviously don't want to be here. You have to embrace that environment and you know, kind of traverse that world and trying to understand what's happened, what has happened. Because if you don't, if I fail to do my job in that moment, as ghastly as that is, that's information I can't cross over the threshold for the first time again. I can't do that.
Right.
So you have to lay it all out every single time you do it. And it's not just decomps. I know I'm running on about that, but you know, horrible things. We deal with dead kids, and you know, you're trying to understand that, what the dynamic of that was, you know, and you see every kind of possible horror that you can imagine within your little jurisdiction. Doesn't mean you ever see anything. And I always tell folks, if you ever come across somebody in forensics that says that they've seen everything,
They haven't been doing it long enough.
run, don't walk away from them. Run away from them because they're lying. They haven't. There's always something else that you can see.
Now, you just one of the we took some questions from some people when we knew we were having you on, and that was one of them that came up was like the time of death thing, obviously super, super important. So how does that see? I understand, okay, you get there, you know, again, I'm going off of what what you see in Law and Order, the body's still warm, or you know, his watch cracked at a certain time. But you know, I would imagine it gets increasingly difficult between 12 and 24 hours. But you know, when you start to get to the decomposition, which I would imagine happens somewhere between a day and maybe a week.
Yeah, dependent upon the environmental conditions in which the body is found. Just so people understand, I'm in Alabama, okay? And so I'm at a higher elevation here in Alabama. I'm at the very end of the Appalachian chain, all right? But if you go to South Alabama, where you're approaching Florida, that's a completely different environment down there than it is up here. So bodies, you know, you could have two people that die of the same cause of death at the same time, and if they're left out in the elements, their bodies are going to decay at a different rate. So you have to be attuned to that, and not just decay, but what we refer to as postmortem changes. And the big thing that we go to in that is something we refer to as it's called PMI. It's postmortem interval. And right, you were, you know, when you mentioned that it might be, I think probably at the scene, it's probably the most critical assessment that we do. And it's made up of multiple components. You know, we look at, and all of these things are time framed, okay? So you can have one of these things going on as the other is occurring. So you have rigor mortis, which or rigor mortis, which people are all familiar with, the stiffening of the joints. Well, there's a measured time frame in which that happens. Now, it can be slowed, dependent upon environmental temperature, or it can be sped up dependent upon environmental temperature. It can also be sped up as a result of any kind of metabolic activity, like a fever that someone was experiencing prior to death. You have alger mortis, which is the cooling of the body, but cooling of the body is not necessarily accurate because not all bodies cool after death. So, to my point, if I have someone that drops dead in a parking lot in Alabama in the middle of July, the asphalt that they're laying on is a bit warmer than 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay. So their body is not going to lose that indwelling temperature signature that's left behind. We try to measure that. The problem is the people that originally did a lot of these measurements, they did it under what are referred to as ideal conditions.
Right.
And death investigation, there's no such thing as an ideal condition because it's all variable everywhere we go, you know. And then my favorite in particular is what's referred to as livor mortis or postmortem lividity, which is the settling of blood. So that's not dependent upon temperature at all. It's dependent upon the one constant force in nature that is impacting us right now as we sit here, and that's gravity.
Right.
So, you know, my big behind is sitting here in this chair. If I were to kick off this mortal coil right now as I was seated here, my heart obviously would stop pumping.
Right.
If I remain in this position, then the blood that's circulating through my body, just like water underneath and going into the basement of a house, it's going to seek the lowest point of gravity. So that takes time to, first off, it takes time for the blood to seek that area. And then it takes time, a prescribed measure of time, for that blood to fix, which means if it goes into the capillary beds, which we learned that in basic science in school, right? Once it sits in there, blood vessels are not intended to store blood. So they can only stand so much tension and pressure, and they'll start to, I hate to use the term explode, it's not really exploding, it's kind of seepage, and it seeps out into what's called the interstitial tissue. And once it's there, you can't get rid of it. So if you depress your arm right here, it, well, let me do it on this side. You depress your arm right here, and my skin blanches. Your skin will blanch too because
Alive.
you're preventing the flow of blood, right? Well,
Yeah, the
if
settling
it
of
picked,
it.
if you're settled like this, your arms will turn purple, for
Yeah.
instance. Once it's fixed, and it takes a prescribed amount of time for it to fix, then you know that that person has been dead for a predictable amount of time. Within, we can't give you, I think that's the big thing that people believe. We can give you an absolute time.
Yeah, 9:46, 2 days ago.
Can't do that. That's an empirical impossibility. People have thought that they've come up with a formula for years and years and years, and probably the most worthless data that you can get is probably body temperature. Because a lot of people over the years have thought about ways to determine body temperature. They do, the ear, they'll actually do rectal temperatures on the dead,
Oh.
which is really stupid because if that becomes part of your SOP and you're going to go to court with this, then if you're dealing with a rape case,
Yeah, that was my first thought. It was obviously the muscles, and
well, is that,
they can tell that the rectum's been entered.
right? If you've got a potential sexual assault case, is that data really worth
You can't be
disrupting?
touched. Yeah, no, I get it.
Might be there. And if you do it for one, you got to do it for all. Because if they find out, they being the attorneys, find out, then that's a problem. And other people have, and this is kind of, it's almost laughable to me. Core body temperature is achieved. The densest organ that we have in our body and our abdomen is our liver. So this is what they prescribe. And this is, it's sad to me, but they suggest that at scenes that you take a scalpel at a scene, you make an incision, find your last rib anteriorly, okay? Your liver on the right side, your liver rests right there. You make an incision right there, Derek. Take a digital
Take the
thermometer,
temperature, yeah.
stick it into the liver, and you have to do it a couple of times. So let me get this straight. If I've got a body that's riddled with bullets, or I've got multiple stab wounds, even worse, you're saying that I am supposed to
Find the liver.
incise a body and create another insult to the body. And oh, by the way, this little caveat that they suggest that you do. Is, I can't believe I'm saying this. You're supposed to carry a magic marker with you,
Yeah.
make a circle around your incision and put your initials on it. Oh, so now you want me to draw on the body and put my initials on it. Indicate you did this. And we're talking about cases. I mean, how much do we talk about touch DNA now and about, these elements that are left behind? There are so
Unbelievable, yeah.
they this is one of the things they suggest. It's the data that you glean from that is not worth the gunpowder to blow it to hell. So you know what my measure is? Yeah, the body's warm to the touch or the body's cool to the touch. That's about it. That's as far as I'm going. I'm not incising a body and sticking a digital thermometer. And you're at a crime scene. You can't remove the body from the scene to do it because you have to do it in the environment. I've been on homicide scenes, Derek, where I had 300 and 400 people standing around a crowd outside the tape staring at me. Can you imagine if I brought a scalpel out
You
and
know what? I think of both sides of it. I think of you, at your office, they bring in a body that the rectum's been stretched out, they've been cut open, and there's black magic markings saying Officer Johnson in his
yeah,
badge number.
it's ridiculous. So, I don't know. I don't know that we'll ever necessarily have all of the answers relative to PMI. It's fascinating because you have to have it. I think that the degree of rigidity in the body is key. If anyone ever wants to read a really, and it's public record, you can see this. If you ever want to read a really good autopsy, well-written autopsy, let me rephrase that. Well, the autopsy report is good too, but the ME investigator's report, read Robin Williams' scene report from the scene. And they talk about, you'll see them describe the level of rigidity and they use a scale to do it with. It really, that investigator that handled that case involving Mr. Williams was right on cue. I mean, they were, that's, that would be the gold standard. And I use that case in my classes to teach my
No
students.
kidding. It's got your 100% stamp of approval.
It does. It truly does. And I look for cases, like that, because I do show bad examples as well. I could show them a few of my old reports.
Well, you know what the thing is, though? I if it's like anything else in law enforcement and in the legal community and everything, is you'll learn more from the fails than you will from the successes.
You're absolutely right. And I personally, I've learned more from the myriad of failures I've had as a practitioner and as a professor than I ever did, any kind of laurels that were placed at my feet or whatever. That's nothing but ego, but I learned what not to do. It's kind of like being a parent. You say, I wouldn't do that shit if I was you. And so what not to do by looking at examples and seeing outcomes and say, yeah, I'm probably going to try the opposite with my kids or my wife or
Yeah.
yeah.
Unless you want to be married three or four
I'm a simple man, so
So I just wanted to go back just for a second. You said with some of the case, so with some of the cases you worked out, I guess as you moved forward in your career, did you, I don't want to say look forward to a challenge, but day in and day out, if you were doing the same thing, and like you said, if it's a 25 gunshot, 25 bullet wounds, where you can kind of get that, like have you had ones either in the field or that were brought to you where you really had to kind of put on your thinking cap? Like, does one stick out in general?
Yeah, pretty much. I became less and less fascinated by firearms related homicides pretty quickly. It runs its course with you.
I would imagine, especially when you said you had to deal with kids and stuff. I mean, that can't be easy.
Yeah, and that's one of those things where it's like the stuff that was more intriguing to me, I think probably were what the medical community conveniently refers to as medical misadventures. Isn't it interesting, if you're a non-physician and you bring about somebody's death, they'll refer to it as manslaughter.
Right.
She does it, they call it a medical misadventure.
Yeah.
And I'll give you an example recently, and I actually did an episode of Body Bags about this tragic case out of Clayton County, Georgia, where the physician in the case was attempting to deliver a baby, and she was attempting, the baby I think had breached or shoulders were caught, young mother, and she essentially decapitated the baby.
Yeah, I read about it. Yeah, that just got classified as a homicide.
And homicide, yeah, and kudos to the ME because they ruled that as a homicide, and then the police department stepped in and said, we're going to begin our investigation. And I'm thinking, dude, it's you're just starting the investigation.
Yeah.
And medical community many times gets a pass because you assume that, well, they're trustworthy and we can depend upon them and all those sorts of things. This is not a medical misadventure, okay? So it's digging into those kind of cases, I think, were always more intellectually stimulating to me. Of course, that's a trauma case, but you can have things that are, say, related to, some kind of exotic poison. Maybe some diagnoses was missed in the hospital during the course of treatment. I've had people that have died as a result of heavy metal poisonings over the course of my career, where they're being dosed by somebody in their family. Those are pretty intellectually stimulating.
Really?
And I guess I've got enough little boy in me, where I was always fascinated by working industrial accidents because I've had an opportunity during the course of my career to go and see things that other people might not ever see.
Well, that's the you just said industrial accident. Like you're hearing, like, I don't want to say like a nuclear plant or like a sawmill or something like that.
I've never worked a sawmill death, but I've worked people that have gotten caught up in a plow before. I've had tractors turn over on people. Back to New Orleans, I had a guy that, and this was fascinating. He was a, again, forgive me, he's a machinist mate. I think that's what they're referred to as. He went into, and I didn't even know this existed, Derek. This is a super tanker that had made port in New Orleans. And if you've never seen a super tanker, there's a reason they're called super tankers. You stand there and you just kind of, you look up at this thing and you first off, you look at it and you think, I can't believe men made this,
Yeah.
built this, Well, they had a, what I was told was the gear room. And the gear room is what is the area that the gears literally controlled the rudders on this massive vessel. And this guy went into the gear room and got caught in the gears. And I had never seen anything like that. I had a guy that fell through an open hold on a tanker as well. He was drunk, had taken the gangplank off. They and with the ships, they push them up to the shore with tugs, and the tugs will anchor on the
Yeah.
outside. They'll take a gangplank and bring it down to the levee, the top of the levee. Everybody hears about the levees in New Orleans, how they break or did during Katrina.
Or when they're dry.
Levees dry. So when the levee breaks, baby. So anyway, this guy was drunk. And he, somebody left a hatch open and he fell. And dude, when he fell, I mean, he felt stories. The tanker was empty. It had been carrying cooking oil. And I had to go down into the bottom of this thing and he fell. I couldn't tell you how many feet. It was multiple stories. And I'll never forget, I was terrified. I had no safety gear on. I had to go down inside of the place and climb down. With my gear bag over my shoulder to take photographs down there. Who else is going to go? Nobody. I mean, I'm the
Wasn't it
one.
slick from the oil?
It's very slick. I was terrified the entire time. But, I look back at that, and that's something that you do, now is this.
Your
I'd say you're out of your mind. I'm not doing
days of climbing down into slick holes are over.
it. Yeah, there you go. Learn that lesson. When you're 23 or 24, though,
Right.
you can continue that conversation on
Yeah.
multiple planes, but you look at that and you find as horrible as these events are, I have to say that for me, I've led a very interesting existence to see things and to do things that not many other people have had an opportunity to do. And then once you get, because I've got it, I was saying that there's enough little boy in me about, things to tinker with and mechanisms and all this sort of stuff that you wouldn't normally have access to. You have to get past your being bedazzled by all that and go back to the science and try to understand,
Because at the end of the day, you have a job to do.
yeah, how this mechanism works. I was always fascinated with trains. Well, I worked a lot of cases with trains. And it's horrible, but people say, how could you want to do that? It's not that I necessarily want to do it. It's that I have a skill set to do it. I've trained at that skill set and I'm not shy about going out there to do it. Nobody else is raising their hand. Who else wants to deal with a maggot infested body? Hands go into pockets.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Let's go take a look. This is part of the natural process.
Like, do you have, like you were saying with the intro and kind of a medium level, the classes that you teach, like, is there a point where you could say earlier on, yeah, sorry, early on with the kid, the students to say, like, this is not for everybody. Like, is there like a one out of three of you will fail, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I try to talk every kid that comes to me in forensics. I try to talk them out of my field. I never promote my field to these kids because I know the price that's paid.
Well, you see,
I would much rather see them going to DNA or Leighton Prince or something like that than kids that actively seek out wanting to tell the tales of the dead. It takes a person of a particular stripe to do that. We need bright people in the field doing it, but people will hear my stories, these things that, I'm kind of talking about right now, and they're bedazzled by it. there's that word again, have to come up with something else. They're awed by it, I think, to a certain, because it's death, has nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
It's death. Everybody's interested in death. But, late at night when you're laying in bed, demons come around, man.
Oh, yeah.
Those things that haunt your dreams that you've seen that no one else has borne witness to. And there's really nobody else you can talk to about it. Even cops, you can't talk to about it, because if it's not a homicide, they lose interest really quick. And there's not too many people in my field nationwide. There's just not a lot of people that do what I did for a living. And there's a lot of burnout, and there's not a lot of care for these people. I was one of them, where, who are you going to go talk to about it?
Yeah.
And so my knee-jerk reaction is, if a kid comes to me and says, "Hey, I saw an opening in, I don't know, in Kalamazoo," we'll just pull that out of there. I don't know if there's any openings in Kalamazoo currently or not. I think I want to go work as a medical legal death investigator in that area. So what else you got? I'm
Yeah.
gonna move on from that.
Yeah.
We've given you some education in these other areas. What other what else, kind of intellectually blows your hair back?
Well, I see, and like the first thing that I would think of is, not only that you don't have other people to talk to about it, is like, when you close your eyes, like you said, at night, you could probably still see some of this horrifying shit. Just, one of the other things I was going to say, do you have a case that haunts you? Do you have one that you were either close to figuring out, or it was just one of those ones that kind of the one that got away?
Yeah, I had a case for a while that really bothered me. And this is toward the end of my career, with the Emmy in Atlanta. And it was a young, we identified her, well, didn't identify her. The anthropologist and the odontologist, the forensic odontologist, pegged her age 12 to 14 years of age. And we had her skull, some of the long bones, and away from where the primary location of her skeletal remains were found, and some of them had been scattered by animal activity. Her underwear were found bunched up beneath a tree. Now, she was completely skeletonized. There was no soft tissue left. She'd probably been choked to death because we didn't, there was no trauma to the skull. There was no depressed skull fracture. There was no gunshot wound, or and there was nothing that we could really put together that she had sustained any kind of blunt force trauma on the rest of her body based upon the limited skeletal remains that we had. And I, it's one thing if you have a case that's involving a an adult, an older adult perhaps, that wanders away and they die. That's sad. It's tragic. I hate that that happens. But when you've got this very young girl, and I'm thinking about, being there, and I'll never forget, it was behind a Coca-Cola bottling factory in kind of a pine thicket. And I'm thinking, in those last moments of her life, I think that she was taken back there, choked out, raped, and no one ever heard her scream.
Yeah.
She's so young back then. You're thinking, there's a mama out there somewhere that's missing her baby,
Yep.
and you can't, and it wasn't. Maybe 2 years later, I was gone. By that point in time, it had just taken a toll. I couldn't do it anymore. But those cases haunt me. That case did. And I have other ones where there was habitual or chronic abuse of individuals that finally succumbed, both the elderly and young kids, where, it was, and still to this day, we cover cases like this where it was preventable. And nobody made the effort to prevent it.
Yeah.
And, those cases always truly bothered me. And those are the ones that kind of, haunt my dreams, I think, to a great degree.
Yeah, because again, like we were talking about before, like checking your boxes and crossing your T's, because you've walked that scene, you did your job to the best you could have done, but there's always that, did I miss something? Is there something like that? Just, I don't know. It seems to me like an impossible job.
It is, and it's impossible, because one of the other things that I had to do, I think a lot of people have a this kind of confused notion of what people in my field do we're the eyes and the ears, as I'd mentioned, of the forensic pathologist in the field because we're collecting the data. Contrary to what you see on television, pathologists do not go to scenes. If they do, it's rare, and you would not want them at the scene because it's not,
You're just getting in the way.
that's not their bag. It's just not what they do. And so it's best if you're out there to glean the data and bring it back into them. But the other portion of what we do in the medical legal field is notify families. And that was probably the worst part of my job. I had to do hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of in-person notifications.
It sounds like it's all the worst part, but it's, a lot of the stuff you've been telling us, it just gets,
It is the absolute worst. I think I even wrote about one incident in Blood Beneath My Feet where I had to notify the same family on two separate occasions
Oh,
within
shit.
3 months of both of their sons. One was killed in a motorcycle accident. And then the second son was a reserve deputy sheriff, barricaded himself into a hotel room and shot himself. And I went back to the same home, notified the mother and the father again. And it was one of those kind of, it was one of those very visceral things where, they opened the door after I knocked on it, and there I was staring at them again. And this isn't the most pleasant thing to see. It burned into their soul, you can imagine. And
Damn.
anybody that's in the sound of my voice right now, if you can reflect back, and this is really horrible, but this is the reality. If you can reflect back, think about the person that maybe was dearest to you in your life and you lost them. I can almost guarantee it that you still remember
The person who told you.
what the person who told you and where you were,
Yeah.
even the time of the day. There are people that even remember smells. That's how powerful it is. At that moment in time when they found out that their loved one was gone, and in this case, and particularly, I compare it to, because I don't know these people. You just get it randomly. And I compared it to pulling a pin on a live grenade and throwing it into a room and shutting the door behind you.
Twice. Yeah.
Their life from that moment in time, Derek, is changed for forever and ever. Amen. There's nothing you can do
Yeah.
to go back from that. And it's not that you're some malevolent force that's looking to do this. You do it the best way you can. And that's the conundrum as a death investigator, because I've got family. I've got kids and I've got grandkids now, and a beautiful wife that takes care of me. And I don't I only have so much love in my love bank. I can't wrap my arms around everybody that's feeling pain.
Yeah, especially
There's
in your business because your
part
arms aren't
of
long.
you that wants to, but that's the most dangerous thing that you can possibly do. And so you just move on from one. I'll put it to you this way. I still remember the first one. I remember the last one. And there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds in between there. It never changed. It was always horrible.
I've already kept you for an hour. I don't want to keep you forever, but I did want to talk about the book just for a second.
Yeah, sure.
Was again, like the podcast, the book very blunt, very details and all that sort of thing. Now, I know we've talked to a lot of people that have written books, and from time to time you'll get the distributor or who's ever working with you on it will say, try to take it easy because you don't want it to be, I don't want to say an X-rated book, but a book that horrifies people. But again, if anybody out there gets the chance to read it, from like what Joseph is saying now, there's so much just horror to this the whole situation of death investigation, but it's necessary. So did you try to pull punches when you were writing the book, or it was just put it all down and see how it comes out?
Short things. As a matter of fact, you can tell the book is very short. It's not very long, but I was, I think, looking back, I think I left almost 40,000 words on the floor.
Why?
My publisher,
Yeah.
at the time, they wanted to keep it very abbreviated. If you were to try to describe it, it's like eating a very heavy meal. There's not, and it was written from a place of. It's an accidental book, really, is what it was. I did not sit down with the intent of writing a memoir. At the time when I wrote that thing, I was there's something very pretentious about writing a memoir per se when you're that young. As young as I was, it was done therapeutically, and it had been suggested because I don't know about you, man, but when you were in school, did you ever have the teacher that said, "Okay, class, we're going to start journaling today"? I hate that. I would rather get my gum scraped than to. It's tedious. It's boring. I hate it. But I finally got to a point in my life, Derek, where I had to do it. I think it was my salvation mentally. And I had something to say at that point in time. And it was really the only way, and I'm not a professionally trained writer. I've always written technical stuff. That's the first thing I've ever written. I've never written anything else. I wrote an article afterwards because of that, that got republished in like eight different languages for Vice. And I didn't even know what Vice was, man. And it took off like gangbusters. But when I wrote that, it was like a collection. It's very nonlinear. As a matter of fact, that chapter that starts off, where it starts, that's literally the end of my career. So the book starts at the end of my career. And some of it just sounds like bitching, and it is. And it's almost like me shaking my fist at death. There's a couple of times in the book where I kind of anthropomorphize death, and death is there speaking to me. And I felt like death was a companion in a weird way. I know that sounds terribly ghastly, but that was the way I had to do it. And I essentially, the old writing metaphor about bleeding on the page. I did. I bled on the keyboard. There were tears that were shed, and but it's kind of like a big fistula. You have to lance it. You have to get it out of you and leave it there. And if people choose to read it. I think that there was some level of disappointment. People have picked it up, and I find this is kind of an interesting commentary. And thank you for your kind words about it. But there have been several people that have read it, and they thought that it was going to be a true crime book, and then they would write a review, or I've had people send emails that would say, "I don't care about your depression. I don't care about this. We just
Yeah,
want to, we just."
I saw some of those reviews when I went through it on Amazon, and it was like you could just tell. You said something really interesting earlier, and then which kind of coincides with the book, which is I think it's interesting, was you had a lot of pain, you had a lot of the suffering and all that, but it was because of the work, and you were saying you didn't really have anyone to talk to and all that sort of thing. So the book is almost like the first conversation you'd be able to have about a lot of the shit that was going on with you that was
Right.
written down now. A, I don't want to shit talk your publisher, but if I was putting that book out, I would have wanted those other 40,000. I would have,
I
go Shakespeare if you want to.
would have wanted it too, but happily, the book, there's been a screenplay written for the book. Actually by a fellow New Orleanian. And right now it's kind of floating about. So I'm hoping for good things relative to that. And it's kind of a fictionalization of my life, I guess, to a great degree. But it deals with some of the themes that I deal with, and of working through what it takes to after you viewed death every single day of life, and how do you combat that? Well, for me, I actually had a therapist that told me at one point in time, do you think it's a good idea for you to be in academia? Because you're going to be teaching and reliving. And it's like, actually, Derek, it was the best thing for me because I don't have to pay a therapist. And don't get me wrong, I don't sit there with my class and talk about, what it's like to sit there and,
I'm sad today. I gotta tell you
I
all.
don't do that. But it validates the learning that I did early on, that it served a higher purpose. And I've got a lot of kids all over the world now that are practicing in forensics. I've been doing this for 20 years as a professor. So I've got kids that are working in Europe. I've got kids that are in Southeast Asia, got kids all over America that I had the privilege of teaching. And so whatever whatever I went through at that point in time, and God bless my family because they stuck by me, it is a payment in and of itself, I think, and a validation based upon I have kids that contact me now and say, well, I learned this from you and I applied it in a homicide that I worked. That's a hell of a gift. For
Unbelievable.
me it
Yeah.
is.
Yeah.
And
Well,
so
you know,
I've always relished that.
it's a strange way for what you've done to kind of come full circle.
Yeah.
It does sound like you had a lot of pain and stuff, that cases haunting you and all that sort of thing. Where, what do you do with that information? I would imagine, we talked on this show, we have a lot of law enforcement people, FBI agents, lawyers and stuff. And they said, when you first start off, they're like, well, who gives a shit about the death investigator or the lawyer? And then you're like, you know what? The lawyer represented somebody that was innocent, just got 10 years in jail. How does he go to sleep at night?
Yeah,
Joseph
yeah.
Scott Morgan went out to a crime scene. He can't find out how they died or who the killer is of a 14-year-old girl. Like, that is something that you can't just wake up the next day and pretend it didn't happen. But this way, you pass that information on to somebody else and how you dealt with it. Maybe you help somebody else, or dozens or hundreds of people, which I think that's fantastic.
I hope so. And I hope that people that are currently occupying those positions, because Derek, I mean, right now, as we're speaking, there's somebody out there getting notified, multiple people getting notified. And it's not necessarily a homicide they're being notified of, but somebody that was very precious to them, somebody that they really loved. There's somebody knocking at their door right now, as we speak, telling them that they've lost that person.
Yeah.
There's some investigator that's out there that's standing over a maggot-infested body right now. I mean, we'll just say that plainly. And they're viewing things that most of us cannot even fathom. But they're having to make sense of that all. And they're going to go, once they write that report, guess what? The phone's going to ring. They're going to go out and do it again.
Yeah.
People are not aware of it. It's like my wife said, early on before we got married, I never thought about death till I met you.
Yeah, now it's all I can think about.
So, yeah, I mean, look, I hope that it does. I hope that it does help people. I've had firefighters, EMTs, police officers. Actually some soldiers over the period of time that says I've gone through some of this, and you framed it in a way that, and it's just my old country ass, southern guy, that just wrote it down, and I kind of just let it, come forth from me as I was writing it down, and hopefully it touched some people and it helped people. I hope it did.
Well, because it was honest and it was blunt. And again, that's what if you had written the first half of the book where it was, kind of beating around the bush and all that sort of thing, okay, it's a good read, but it's not going to help anyone.
No, it's not. One of the, and I don't, I don't necessarily want to go too far afield with this, but I'm of the opinion we as a people would be a lot better served if we still had contact with the dead, in the sense of, I'm not talking about spiritual sense, I'm talking about, in our ancestors' past, they took care of their dead. Now everything is hermetically sealed. We don't, the bodies don't pass through our hands. They're taken off by people with soft voices and perfect hair, and they give you a PowerPoint presentation in a
Yeah,
very raw kind
very
of,
polished.
very polished. My grandmother, who I write about and who practically raised me, whom I adored, she told tales of taking the biggest, finest door off the hinges, and they would put it between two chairs, and they would lay the bodies out of their dead, and they would wash and clean them. They would prepare them, and then they would dig the grave and bury, and this took days. And nowadays, like so many things else in this world, it's like we actually have the nerve to be surprised when somebody dies, because we're so out of touch with death.
Yeah.
We just kind of shove it off and say, here, you take care of that.
Yeah.
And I think it diminishes the value of life, actually, to a great degree. It's a hell of a thing to try to process, but it's so convenient for us now, and we're not set up the way our ancestors used to be, and they don't understand it. People are so very shocked when, someone like me arrives at their doorstep and they're helpless. They don't know what to do, and for good reason. You don't expect to get that kind of news. And so what are the next steps? I think that, what was this? There was a study that was done about, regarding, you have to go through training to make notifications. And I think one of the things that the psychologist, one of the interesting points along the way, when you notify somebody of a death, did you know they only hear, if it's their primary point of contact, they only hear about 10% of what you say as an investigator. And to a person, I think everyone I ever told, I always got a follow-up phone call. And it would go something like this: I've got your card. You came to my house yesterday. You told me that, insert relative, my mom, my dad, my child, whatever, had died. I don't remember anything else you said.
Shit.
And so, and that, dude, that happens over and over and over and over again. And I think that most people that hear this conversation we're having that have had deaths, they'll understand that. It's like getting hit in the forehead with a baseball bat.
Yeah.
It's one of the worst experiences anybody can go through. But yet, we don't give people appropriate amount of time to grieve many times. So it's something less than tactile for them.
Yeah.
It can be that way. And I think that's unfortunate.
Well, listen, man, I can't thank you enough. So, for more Joseph Scott Morgan, follow him on Twitter at Joe Scott Forensic or on Instagram at Joseph Scott Morgan. That's where you can find out when he's on TV and everything else that he does. It's amazing. Download the podcast Body Bags wherever you get your podcast. And if you want to read an amazing, albeit horrifying book, go pick up Blood Beneath My Feet, The Journey of a Southern Death Investigator. Again, Joseph Scott Morgan, I cannot thank you enough. This is amazing.
Thank you, Derek. It's good to be with you.